Welcome to my monthly podcast series titled Becoming a Sage. My name is Jan Fried, but you can call me Dr. Jan. I blog about leading, living, and saging, or conscious aging. I'm passionate about helping people get from where they are to where they want to be, particularly in the second half of life. I also say I'm out to retire the word retirement. We are not retiring, and we're certainly not retiring from life, but we're moving on to something else, and I believe it takes time and intentional thought to successfully move on to what's next in life. Today I'm interviewing Rabbi Laura Geller, Rabbi Emerita of Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills, twice named one of Newsweek's 50 most influential rabbis in America, was named by PBS Next Avenue as one of the 50 2017 influencers in aging. I'm very honored to be interviewing Rabbi Geller today. Prior to becoming one of the first women to be selected through a national search to lead a major metropolitan synagogue, Rabbi Geller served as the director of Hillel of University of Southern California for 14 years and as the Pacific Southwest region's executive director of the American Jewish Congress for 4 years. She was featured in a PBS documentary, Jewish Americans. She's the author of numerous articles and books. She serves on the boards, many boards, but the board of Encore.org, which has been very influential in my work, and the Jewish Women's Archives. Ordained by Hebrew Union College in 1976, she is the third woman in the Reform movement to become a rabbi. For more information on Rabbi Geller, please refer to the bio attached to this podcast. A welcome to Becoming a Sage series, Rabbi Geller.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be part of it.
Yes. Well, thank you. Well, what, since I focus on aging, positive aging, saging, what prompted you to begin to think about growing older and eventually write your book?
So it actually probably began about 5 or 6 years ago as I was beginning to imagine my stepping back from my role as senior rabbi of Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills. And I was curious to notice that the people who were leaving the synagogue tended to be people who were in this new stage of life between midlife and frail old age. But they were also the ones who were coming to learning or to spiritual services. So I was curious about what was going on because, in fact, that is my cohort. Mm-hmm. So we began a listening campaign at the congregation where we talked with over about 250 congregants who are boomers and slightly beyond, people from, let's say, 55 to maybe mid-70s, in small gatherings in people's homes about what mattered to them at this stage of their life. We asked them, was this a new stage, this stage between maturity and frail old age? How did they feel about it? What did they call it? And what does it mean when you know that there's less time ahead than there was behind? We asked them what keeps them up at night, what their concerns were, and what got them up in the morning. And in these conversations, we discovered that there were four fears. People in this age stage feared becoming invisible. Asking questions like my question, who am I when I'm no longer the senior rabbi of Temple Emmanuel? People were afraid of becoming isolated. Who's my community now that I no longer have work colleagues or that my kids' friends' parents are no longer in my life and many old friends have moved away? People were concerned about being without purpose. Well, what do I do all day? And people were very concerned about becoming dependent. God forbid that I should ever be dependent, especially on my children. And that was even more intense for those in the congregation who didn't have children or family. So those four fears. And then there were four themes that emerged. The themes were people wanted to give back. They wanted to think about community. They had questions about spirituality. And they had a lot of concerns about themselves and people they loved, particularly end-of-life issues. So what we learned was that people in this stage of life want to continue to live lives of meaning and purpose. And they were asking, what is our purpose now when we're more distant from work or child rearing that used to fill our days? The real question was, how can we get good at finding meaning and purpose in the time we have left? So that was one of the things we learned. The second thing we learned is that people at this stage have more time to ask existential and spiritual questions than they did when they were so busy building careers and raising families. They wanted to continue to learn and to grow, and they were also interested in the question of ritual. How do you mark the transitions in this new stage of life? In a religious tradition like Judaism or many other traditions that have many life cycle rituals for the early part of life, but very few for the stage between marriage and death.
Right.
Then people were concerned about themselves and the people they loved, health, finances, end-of-life issues, how to talk with their adult children about end-of-life issues. And most important, they were wanting to explore the issue of legacy. What would they leave behind? And how to think consciously and intentionally about what legacy is. And finally, we learned that people at this stage really were beginning to ask the question, with whom do I want to grow older and where? And that led to lots of interesting possibilities for reimagining community as we get older. So that was the, that's what kind of kicked off my interest in all of this and led to the book that my late husband and I wrote called Getting Good at Getting Older. So I can tell you more about the book in subsequent questions.
Right, right. And I read a great review on the about the book that I've kind of integrated into another question here. But I even love the title, Getting Good at Getting Older.
I think it's a good title, too.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. Well, that is just, I'll tell you what, you have one smart congregation. I mean,
it's true. Well,
you really do.
Actually, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people in this stage of life all around the country, some in faith communities and others not, who are wrestling with these same kinds of questions.
Yes. And just so you, if I forget to say later, I'm definitely, based on that book review, I'm definitely buying your book. So
great. By the way, it makes a wonderful Hanukkah or Christmas present for people that you love.
Right. There you go. That's great. Well, perfect. Well, why do you call the stage between raising families and building careers and frail old age a new stage? Why is it so hard to name this? I mean, sometimes people, you know, third chapter, second act, well, third act, second half of life. You know, there are different names being thrown around there. What do you use?
Well, first of all, it's important to notice that it is a new stage. As you well know, social scientists tell us that people are living 31 years longer than our grandparents did. Mm-hmm. And they're not 31 years tapped at the end of our lives, but they're 31 years between maturity and frail old age, a time when people, you know, with the luck of good health, have a lot of energy, have experience, some have disposable resources, talent, and want to use it in ways that perhaps our grandparents didn't. When my grandparents retired, they moved to Florida and they played golf. When my parents retired, they moved to Florida and they played golf. I'm an East Coast person. I'm not moving. I am now retired, but I'm still quite actively engaged in my community and in, you know, work around this issue. So while I'm not working in a technical sense, I am still quite engaged. It's a new stage.
Right.
What do you call it? What is it, retired? Well, I'm retired, but I'm not exactly retired from the world in the way that my parents and grandparents were.
Right.
Do you call me a boomer? Well, I'm technically a boomer, born between 1946 and 1964. But we're not really talking just about boomers. We're talking about a really new stage of life. Someday my millennial children will be in this stage between midlife and frail old age. So what we do, how we imagine this stage of our life is critical, not just for those of us that are in it now, but it's a new way to imagine a lifestyle, a life stage,
right?
Life cycle. Not unlike, by the way, adolescence, which didn't exist until 1904, I think, the first time the word was used. And it didn't become part of, you know, the conversation really until the 1920s. So we think of life stages as biologically given, but in fact, they're really not. They're socially constructed. Mm-hmm. Just as an example, there's another new stage, and that is the stage between, it's called emerging adulthood. The stage where our millennial children come home. It's actually described in the literature, and now I'm quoting, as a time of instability, self-focus, and identity exploration, which exists mostly in advanced industrialized countries and is usually confined to the affluent and college-educated. Okay? A new stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, when I was at that age, I didn't move home.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you call that? Time magazine created the term Twixters to describe this emerging adulthood. And in England, apparently, they're called Kippers, which is an acronym for Kids in Parents' Pockets, Eroding Retirement Savings. So, you know, how we call these stages is important. So what do we call it? I mean, senior. You know, I like that movies are less expensive, but I don't really love the word.
All right, elder? I know. Yeah, do you like the word elder?
It sounds too old or too pretentious. The encore generation, the third chapter. I actually really like the phrase perennial, which a colleague at Stanford suggested. It's good because it imagines that we're still growing, and I think that that's important. It was Dr. Laura Karstensen from the Stanford Center of Longevity.
Who said,
she says about that, the symbolism is perfect. We're still here, blossoming again and again. It also suggests a new model of life in which people engage and take breaks, making new starts repeatedly. Perennials aren't guaranteed to blossom year after year, but given proper conditions, good soil, and nutrients, they can go on for decades.
I love that.
Dr. Laura Karstensen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hold on, I'm making notes here. Because, yeah, definitely the Stanford Longevity Center or whatever, they're very influential. Very good. Excellent. Wow. Well, that's a great question. That's wonderful. I love it. What do you think keeps people in this stage up at night? And what gets them up in the morning?
Well, again, what their fears were, that they would be invisible, that they would be isolated, that they would not know what to do with themselves, and that they would become dependent.
Right.
And what we've discovered in the work since the listening campaign that's led to some really interesting new ways of imagining community as you get older, what we've really come to understand is that nobody is ever independent.
Right.
All of us at all stages of our lives are dependent in some ways. So I think the trick of this stage of our life is to learn to nurture a life-affirming notion of interdependence.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could do that, that would go a long way towards helping people in this stage, or actually throughout their whole life, of being able to be present to people and also accept the health and the help and the connection that we all need from other human beings. So interdependence is really what people are looking for. And so that is, you know, the fear of being dependent is one of the fears.
Yes.
As is, you know, the kind of challenges of growing older, you know, issues of finance and health, and specifically also these end of life issues, which are really important for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. In fact, one of the things that I was wondering when I read the book review is, did you know Rabbi Schachter Shalomi?
He was a major teacher to my late husband, Richard Siegel.
Okay.
And you know that Reb Zalman wrote a book years ago called From Aging to Saging.
Right. And see, I'm...
Which,
I'm certified because, as a saging leader through that organization. And I got to meet him a couple times or hear him speak at a conference.
So he's definitely, you know, you know, part of the reason that a book like this could be written. And specifically, as I said, Rich was, you know, Zalman was a major teacher of Rich. The thing about Reb Zalman is he was so ahead of his time in everything that he did that if he had been writing the book now, it would have been a bestseller.
Yeah,
but
I know.
He wrote it in a way too early for, I mean, people were not ready to hear what he had to say. Now I think people are. And one of the chapters in our book is borrowed with permission from that book.
I love that.
And it's about, and it's called Exercises for Age for Sages in Training.
I love that. Well, that's, I'm so glad to know that. So I go to their conference, which is held every other year. And definitely I financially support the organization because I believe in it so strongly.
Yes.
Well, give some examples about how do relationships change as we get older?
Well, they change in so many different ways. Friendship changes as the people that were your friends when you were working, if you were working, you know, your work colleagues aren't in your life so much anymore. Good friends have moved away. People die. And I think one of the real challenges of this stage of life is to recognize that there's less time ahead than there was behind. And who are the people that you want in your life? How do you cultivate and deepen relationships with old friends, particularly if they live far away? How do you decide that some relationships are toxic and you just don't really have the time for them anymore? How do you let go of friends? There are issues of relationships with some of us still have much older parents still alive. Some of us have millennial kids that are home. How do those relationships change? You know, when we were young, we spoke of ourselves as the sandwich generation. Sometimes I feel like I'm living in the panini generation because it's a lot more squished between my 97-year-old mother and my 30-year-old daughter. You know, those, how do you negotiate those relationships? So many of my friends have their millennial kids move back in for a certain amount of time. What are the rules? How do you imagine that? They're not kids anymore. They're grown-ups, but they're living in your house. What are the kinds of questions that you should be asking each other? The book that we wrote is a toolkit. So it doesn't, it's not a sermon. It's a toolkit. It's, if this is the stage of your life that you're in, it will help you think about how to structure, you know, what the rules ought to be. Do you charge rent? What does that mean? Do you expect chores? Can your millennial children bring their romantic partners home? All of those kinds of questions are things that need to be explored as opposed to simply experienced without any kind of reflection. So those are just examples. Intimate relationships change. In the book, we have a really lovely and I think important article by Robert Gass and Judith Ansara, who do couples work. They wrote a really, I think, helpful piece about how couples, as we get older, find different ways to be intimate than we might have when we were younger as our bodies change and relationships change. So it's very much about the kinds of specific challenges and opportunities that present themselves to us at this stage.
Yeah, no, that's great. You talk about creating rituals. I know that's one aspect in your book for this new stage of life. And I'm a big believer in the value of rituals. But why is this important in this new stage?
It's really interesting when you think about it. I mean, I'm 69, and God willing, I will live for a long time. In my religious tradition, you know, the life cycle rituals start after birth and continue until basically marriage or divorce. And then there are no other life cycle rituals in a traditional Jewish life until a funeral. The irony is that I'm going to live more of my life between marriage and, God willing, my funeral than I did between birth and when I got married. I believe, as a religious person, that the divinity is present at every stage of our life, at every moment. How did we express that? We express it through ritual. So what are the moments in my life, in this new stage, that call out for ritual? And what would it mean for me as part of a religious community to create some of those rituals? You know, ritual not only reflects how a culture looks at a certain moment, but it also encourages us to think about a transition in a certain kind of way. So, for example, I'm going to read a very brief section from the book. This is a from a congregant in my synagogue. Saying goodbye to the house where you raised your children isn't easy, but it's easier if you actually say goodbye. Our daughter, her boyfriend, my husband, and I walked through the rooms of our home, stopping in each one to share good memories and to honor the room for its service. After our journey through time, space, and love, we shed a few tears, toasted the house, and sent it on its way to shelter and protect a new family. Before this ritual, we were stuck, painfully holding on to the house we had built 27 years before when our daughter was born. But after the ritual, we felt joy and contentment as we realized how rich those years had been and how ready we were to let go and move on. An unforeseen benefit is that our daughter's boyfriend now feels more connected to the life and history of our family and says he can't wait to be part of the new memories we make together in our condo. We can't wait either.
That's beautiful. So that's beautiful. Yes.
So that's an example. So, you know, what are some of the moments in our lives? Some of them are moments of loss. Some of them are moments of transition. You know, what's the prayer when you dismantle your parents' home as you move them into a nursing facility? What is the ritual as for them as they move into a new home? How can downsizing be more than just a chore, but a sacred opportunity, you know, a moment of holiness as you think about making space and giving away and what that means? You know, I'm a recent widow, and for me it was very important after the year of mourning that Jewish tradition offers that when I took off my wedding ring, I wanted to do it in a ritual way. So I had to think about who I wanted to be present, what I wanted to communicate, and what it meant to me to publicly within this small group of very close friends indicate to them that with their help, I had made it through this first year. And now my life is going to unfold in ways I can't predict, and I want them to still be there for me. I mean, that ritual was really important. Mm-hmm. And we made it up. We made it up in the sense that it doesn't exist, but now it does. And for me, as a Jewish person, it was important that it felt authentically Jewish, as opposed to simply made up. How do you create a ritual in a tradition that is old that feels authentic? What are the symbols? What are the ritual objects? What are the prayers? And in our book, we suggest moments in the life of a as we grow older where you might think about ritual, and we don't tell you what to do. What we do is offer a way of thinking about it, how to think about space, how to think about time, how to think about community. And give examples so that ultimately people are, you know, we're not scripting things. We are, in fact, giving people opportunities to think it through themselves and to create something that's meaningful for them.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Well, you know, yeah, like I said, I'm a very big believer in rituals. And so I can't wait to buy your book. When I was reading your book review, I loved how you defined work You know, it's a point where you said, you know, yoga isn't work. Meditation isn't work. I can't remember exactly how it went, but you said this stage involves work. And I like
right. The thing is that what we actually said is yoga doesn't work.
Oh, that's
meditation
right.
doesn't work. Psychotherapy doesn't work. You have to work.
Right. And go on and explain what that means. What's the work that people have to do?
I think the work in that sense is the mindfulness of paying attention to what's happening. You know, one of the things that I think has become clear to me, and this is a blessing of being part of a faith community that is intergenerational, you know, a secret to getting good at getting older is having younger friends. But another secret is having older role models, right? So occasionally I see an 85-year-old woman or a 90-year-old woman, and I think, just like Estelle Reiner in When Harry Met Sally,
yeah,
I want what she's having. You know, yeah. What would it take? What would it take me, a 69-year-old, to become that 85-year-old? What work on myself do I have to do? What is the spiritual work? What is the work to discover, you know, what I might be doing in the community that will give meaning and purpose to my life? I have to work. I have to work on cultivating certain kinds of character traits. You know, the most successful people as they get older are people who are able to forgive. So how do I cultivate the capacity for forgiveness? That's work.
Yeah.
How do I cultivate the capacity for gratitude? I think that's hugely important as people get older. Mm-hmm. And it isn't something that you just wish for. Mm-hmm. There are actually, in all of our spiritual traditions, there are practical techniques or strategies or learning that can help us cultivate those dimensions in ourselves. So that's what I mean by work, you know. Mm-hmm. To...
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, in saging, we as you described, we call this the inner work, you know, and too much of our society is focused on external work, meaning
right.
facelifts and, you know, anti-aging creams and you know, everything else that goes with it. So anyway,
one of my favorite chapters in the book is written by Nessa Rappaport, who is a poet and a novelist. And she writes a book called Regarding My Body. And she talks about what it's like to grow older and have our body change.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that it isn't about facelifts and about Botox shots. It's about accepting the changes that happen and finding a way to welcome them as friends, even though it isn't, you know, it's a whole new body that you're in. What does that mean? How do you relate to it without trying to change it? You want to keep it healthy, but, you know, we are all growing older, and it's important to try to accept that as opposed to pretend it isn't true.
Right.
You know, one of the things I think is really critical in this whole conversation, and I know you know about this, is, you know, the society, our world, you know, has negative images of growing older, right? It's seen as a time of decline.
Yes.
No surprise, because we live in an ageist society. The only ism, prejudice, stereotyping that is still acceptable in the world is stereotyping of older people. Ageism is mm-hmm. the only acceptable ism that's left. And so, of course, people want to pretend they're not old. And so you hear, you know, 60 is the new 40 and mm-hmm. 70 is the new 50. And that is just a way of pretending that we're not getting older. I think the challenge for us is to recognize that 70 is the new 70. We're doing it differently, and we want to applaud that we're doing it differently. We don't want to pretend that it isn't happening to us. The thing about ageism is that it's not just out there. The most insidious kind of ageism is the ageism that we have internalized ourselves, mm-hmm. that we hold those stereotypes, and we pretend it isn't happening to ourselves. But of course it is. We're getting older. And, you know, you see, for people in my age cohort, for whom walking in an airport along one of those really long corridors when walking is difficult, whoever invented airports, you know, weren't thinking about people who had little kids in tow or people for whom walking was difficult. You know, how hard it is for people to acknowledge that, you know what, I could ask for a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
There's no shame in that. But until we overcome this internalized ageism that we all have, we're not going to be able to ask for the kind of help that we deserve and need, and we're not going to be able to make the changes in society where it becomes absolutely reasonable that these kinds of changes are made in all these public institutions so that we can experience the world in the fullness of the world even as our bodies are changing.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. Well, your book draws on Jewish wisdom, and I know you've integrated your faith tradition, you know, within these questions, but is the book relevant to people who are not Jewish?
So most of it is. There are some specific issues where, you know, when we talk about planning your funeral, the kind of funeral that we're planning is a, hold on. Sorry. You know, it's a Jewish funeral, right? So that if you are Catholic or if you're a Muslim, you know, it's the specific information that we give. Some of it is useful and some of it isn't. But in general, the book is totally available, you know, for everybody. And some of the reviews that I've received come from people of other faith communities.
Yeah.
But, you know, my husband and I both have been Jewish educators, and we knew that we could write a book that took in the wisdom of Jewish tradition. We weren't certain that we could write a general book about getting good at getting older, although now I think I could.
Oh, yes, you could. I mean, like I said, I can't wait to buy it because it's all very relevant to what I'm interested in, and I just, your examples are great. Well, we're coming to a close, Rabbi, and I always like to ask, what else should I have asked that our listeners need to know? In other words, what words of wisdom on this topic do you want to share? You know, words of wisdom.
So before I actually say that, I want to just say one more thing about the book, which is it's not a book that you read from beginning to end. It's a toolkit, okay. And it offers resources as you are coming across a certain particular issue, you would turn to that chapter in the book, and the book would help you think about it. And then at the end of it, there are tools and resources for how you might want to respond. So it really is a toolkit, not a sermon. And at this stage of our lives, we need help.
We need help
getting good at getting older.
Yep.
And we need
tools and we need resources. So that's perfect.
But I want to say one other thing by way of an example of how you. My advice to people is to try to approach this stage of life with thoughtfulness, mindfulness, and also with a sense of humor. And that's what we try to do in the book. It includes irreverent cartoons and some photographs, including my favorite photograph, which is the backside of Maxine Menster's tombstone in Iowa, which is a recipe for cookies. Apparently, every time someone asked her for her cookie recipe, she would say, "Over my dead body."
Ah, that is too funny. I'm from Iowa. Where in Iowa?
I don't know. It's somewhere at some cemetery that in Iowa. We found it, and we just thought it was a terrific example of what it means to have a sense of humor.
That is great. So, well, thank you very much. You know, you've given us so much to think about, and the emphasis in this series is on learning how to make the rest of life the best of life. And I just can't wait to read your book.
Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to continuing this conversation in future podcasts.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.